bitch, you know you wrong, all the lights all gone. Fuck the corona, fuck the corona. Bitch, you know you wrong, all the ground me gone. Fuck the corona, all the pole tops gone. Fuck the beach and peroxide gone. Bitch, fuck the corona. Fuck the corona.
Welcome to In Those Genes, a science and pop culture podcast that uses genetics to decode the lost histories and futures of African descendants. I'm your host, Dr. Janina Jeff, and me and my team are bringing an episode to you from the comfort of our own homes. Hashtag social distancing. This week, we're doing a special episode on that Rona, a.k.a.
coronavirus,
or as it's scientifically known, SARS-CoV-2. We've decided to pull together and disseminate some Rona knowledge because we are all being bombarded with a lot of information that is often inconsistent and rapidly changing. So today, we are giving you a more bare bones episode. Since we are moving very quickly on this, we may not have the bells and whistles that you typically expect from an episode of In Those Genes, but we will have the culturally relevant actual factuals. Today, I'll give you a rundown of what that Rona is, what we know about it genetically, and I'll tell you about a vaccine being developed to combat the spread of the virus. Then, we will have a Q&A session with Dr. Ashira Blazer, a medical professional currently working in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. Dr. Blazer is here to answer all of your frequently asked questions, from what makes Corona different from the flu, to why Black people are not immune, and why is the spread extremely dangerous for Black folks specifically? Lastly, we'll end with some affirmational vibes about the humanity and the ecosystem of life. I want to tell you that everything we discuss today, especially as it pertains to updated numbers, research, and in some cases, answers, is everything we know up until this point. This is a dynamic process that is changing by the minute, and we want you to be equipped with the most up-to-date information. As such, we will provide some resources in the show notes so you can stay up to date as well. Some questions you can expect to be answered today include, what is coronavirus? Did we get it from bats? Can you get infected with the virus twice? How did it spread this fast so quickly? What a vaccine for the virus may look like? What does it mean to be a carrier of the virus but not develop the disease? Who gets a test? And why do we need viruses to live? Let's get into Genes for the Culture, the segment where I break down genetic concepts using Black culture analogies. On today's Genes for the Culture, we are breaking down what that Rona even is and letting you know about the vaccines that may stop it in its tracks. Let's start with the virus itself. Amongst ourselves, we call it that Rona. But scientifically, that Rona is known as Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome Coronavirus Version 2, the shorthand of which is SARS-CoV-2. The reason the virus is named SARS-CoV-2 is because it's genetically similar to other coronaviruses we've seen before, like SARS and MERS, both of which are severe respiratory diseases. These viruses are called coronaviruses, not because the person who named it liked beer, but because the outer structure of the virus resembles a crown. Our Latin-loving homies know that corona means crown in Latin. COVID-19, on the other hand, is the resulting disease caused by coronavirus. To reiterate, SARS-CoV-2 is the virus and COVID-19 is the illness. So where in the hell did this crown-head-ass virus come from? Viruses are biological agents that like to live their best lives in living organisms. Well, actually, viruses are not technically alive. They're entities that use actual living organisms to replicate. But for the context of this analogy, we're calling that living their best not alive lives. Viruses are biological agents that like to live their best lives in living organisms. They're like your couch surfing friend who moves in, drinks all your juice, and doesn't pay rent. And their main goal is to do this over and over again in as many organisms as it possibly can. Unlike your couch surfing friends, though, viruses can replicate themselves into a whole army of couch surfers hopping from organism to organism.
Yo, couch, nigga, fuck, yo, couch. Yo, couch, nigga, fuck, yo, couch.
Also, unlike your couch surfing friends, viruses don't ask for permission to come in. The coronaviruses in particular like to live their best lives in bats.
So, you know, we got to live our best lives. You know?
Now, a lot of y'all have been out here with your Hotep theories and xenophobic rumors about Chinese folks and bats. Let's dispel these theories now. The coronaviruses love bats, like a couch surfer loves a big old apartment with a huge TV and comfy furniture. The virus naturally likes to procreate in bats. That's because the bat's immune system are conducive to the coronavirus's ability to replicate. But this kind of coronavirus really wanted to get out and see the world. So at some point, the coronavirus made that leap from bat to another species of animal. The working theory right now is that it jumped from bat to pangolin, which is a scaly mammal native to Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. Now, how in the hell do we know this? No, we're no virus whisperers. We can't talk to these niggas and tell them, chill the fuck out. But what we can do is look at the DNA of the virus in the species that it's infecting. As we've done in previous episodes, let's look at DNA as a book. A book that, due to mutations, changes across individuals and across species. When a living organism is infected by a virus, that virus alters that being's DNA, so it edits its book. The coronavirus in bats is the title of one book, and the coronavirus in humans is a whole nother book. These books are about 96% similar, according to recent reports. And because of what we know about the virus, we can assume, because the books are somewhat different given this short period of time, that the coronavirus actually set up shop in another species before hopping on humanity's couch in Wuhan. Please note that this isn't final and the science is being updated by the minute, but this is one of the working hypotheses to how this all started. Please also note that this is what viruses do. There's nothing about a Chinese person's genome or diet that makes them more or less susceptible to coronaviruses. It just so happens that there are live animal markets in China where many species come into contact with one another, thus making it very easy for viruses like that Rona to couch surf to other species. For more about these kind of animal markets, you can watch an informative video published by Vox.com, which we'll link in the show notes. Now, let's talk about the future of that Rona and what kinds of solutions are being proposed from a genetic standpoint. Let's talk about vaccines. So we know that viruses are unwelcome couch surfers, and they like to hop their asses from one species to another species and from one person to another person. Your body has a built-in security system that turns on when a virus comes to stay with you. That system is, you guessed it, your immune system. When your body comes into contact with a virus it's never seen before,
who?
It don't know what to do.
Oh, shit.
It scrambles to get all its weapons together in order to kick out the virus. And sometimes that scrambling process turns into disease, where your body begins enacting lines of defense like fever and cough. And unfortunately, sometimes when folks' bodies aren't capable of dealing with that kind of strain, they pass away. And other times, the body is able to kick out the virus, like Uncle Phil did Jazz. However, when your body has seen a virus before, there's no scramble necessary. It knows exactly what tools are needed to kick that couch surfing virus out. We call those tools antibodies. There are two ways to prepare your body's security system for this. One is to naturally come in contact with the virus. When this happens, if you live, your body successfully develops antibodies to fight off the virus. So it clears the infection and is also prepared if the virus ever comes back. The second is to get a vaccine. Vaccines are any substance that we put into our bodies to build immunity. It's like letting your security team meet the couch surfer for a little bit, and then letting them plan ahead of time for when that nigga really comes knocking. We typically, like in the case of the flu, take a very small weakened version of a virus that is just enough to let your body know to make antibodies, but not enough to get you sick. But like I've said before, viruses mutate. So in the case of the flu, scientists will make a vaccine based on the strain of the virus they predict will infect people. However, sometimes the viruses can mutate in a way that scientists didn't predict, thus making the vaccine less effective. It's like letting the security team meet one version of the virus, and then a totally different dude shows up to couch surf. Another problem when it comes to traditional vaccines is that we actually have to give you a small amount of the virus in order for them to work. That can become particularly problematic when it comes to that Rona. Because the flu has been around for a minute, scientists have had a lot of time and experience in calculating just the right amount of the virus to give folks in order to protect them and not make them sick. In the case of that Rona, we are moving on a much faster timeline. But imagine if we didn't need to actually give folks the virus to vaccinate them. That's a possibility that U.S. scientists are exploring right now. This new vaccine is called mRNA-1273. This was developed through a partnership through the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease with the biotech company Moderna. This clinical trial is being conducted by Kaiser Permanente Washington Health Research Institute in Seattle. Typical vaccines work with your DNA. That means that the weakened portion of the virus must come into contact with you, aka walk up in your home, in order for the vaccine to be effective. And this is extremely risky for several reasons, but the main posing that we might not be able to promise no infection. The new vaccine development is based on the RNA of SARS-CoV-2. We're going to put a link into just what RNA is in the show notes. But essentially, RNA is the middleman between your DNA and making proteins for your bodily functions. In our couch surfer analogy, you can think of RNA as a phone call from a friend. Yeah. This new vaccine is a homie who's called your body's security system and told them to be on the lookout for that couch surfing coronavirus in hopes that your body will begin to make antibodies based on a description of that Rona from the phone call and be prepared to kick that Rona out if it ever ends up at your doorstep. On Monday, the first phase of mRNA-1273 clinical trials started. That means scientists began testing it in humans. The first phase will be 45 healthy individuals, males and non-pregnant females in Washington State between the ages of 18 and 55. Some caveats here include that they are not testing the 60-plus population. The demographic breakdown of Seattle is not reflective of the U.S. population, and 45 is a small sample size. These volunteers will be given a vaccine at day 1 and day 29 via injection in the upper arm. From there, subjects will be monitored for 1 year after the second vaccination. If the vaccine is successful, these folks will have antibodies that prevent them from invasion of that Rona. And if the 1 year mark sounds sobering to you, that's unfortunately the reality of how vaccines and their development work. That is why it is important that we adhere to the safety guidelines being given to us by medical professionals at this time. We, as a global community, need to ensure that Rona doesn't run amok, quickly hopping from couch to couch before we can get a vaccine that can actually kick that motherfucker out once and for all. Check out our show notes for additional resources and information on the development of mRNA 1273. Now, we're heading into Cracking the Code, the segment where we have conversations with kindred spirits. On today's Cracking the Code, we're speaking to yet another Janetta sis. Dr. Ashira Blazer is a physician and currently the only Black woman rheumatologist at NYU, and one of two in the entire state of New York that we know of. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at NYU, and she will be answering some of your frequently asked questions about that Rona. Also, our producer Sam will be chiming in to ask Dr. Blazer questions as well. Before I get started, I wanted to give you a bit of insight of why we are doing this special edition episode. This episode was directly motivated by the community, who looked to us for answers, especially around some erroneous claim that Black people have genomes that protect them from that Rona. Now, at first, this seemed far-fetched to me. But after doing some reading, it turns out this narrative might have started during slavery. In 1740, yellow fever had taken over American coastal cities like Charleston, South Carolina. And one doctor, Dr. Lining, observed the cases on incoming slave ships, recording that all infected were white passengers. His recordings were later used by another physician during another yellow fever outbreak in 1793 in Philadelphia. At this time, half of the population in Philly left. But because of the notes from 1740, a doctor in Philly recommended that all Black people remain and get trained to nurse, caretake, and dig graves for thousands of white people predicted to die of yellow fever. The doctor who recommended this was a well-known abolitionist who was at the time connected with black leaders of the AME church. These black leaders trusted this doctor and his recommendation to keep black people in Philly. They even encouraged their congregations to stay, as it was their Christian duty. It turned out everyone was wrong. Black people were not immune to yellow fever. And as a result, hundreds of African Americans died under this false belief. Incorrect narratives are deadly to our community, and it is the last thing we would want at a time like this, even from people we trust. And we are here today to have a transparent conversation and share facts based on scientific knowledge. Hey, Ashira.
Hey, Janina. How are you?
Girl, I'm dealing. I mean, I have a wave of emotions just up and down every day with COVID-19. And I'm just so grateful that we can have this conversation to talk about it, because there's so much misinformation and things that are going on. And I knew you would be the perfect person to talk to.
Yeah, same. I think we're all going through a wave of emotions and, you know, just professionally, personally, this has been very taxing. So I'm very glad we get to talk about it.
Let's talk specifically, though, because your passion is, you know, very closely related to mine, which is why we have so much fun talking about science every day, because we are so invested in solving and closing the gap in health disparities, particularly for Black folks. So let's discuss specifically what Black people need to know about COVID-19. Like, how can we do this in this scenario?
Yeah, so I think Black people just need to know that we have to protect ourselves the same as everyone else. This is sort of the kind of thing where a community people can protect the whole. So we understand that not everyone's going to be able to work from home. Not everyone is going to be able to stay secluded from the rest of society. But for those of us who can, we need to. We really do. Because the more we take heed, the slower this virus spreads. That's important for a couple of reasons. Whenever you get a sudden surge in a virus that requires hospital care, the hospitals can be overwhelmed. If we can sort of flatten out that curve so that the number of cases are more manageable, then when people do get sick, they can get the care and attention that they need. In New York State alone, it's predicted that if the rise of the virus continues the way that it has already, we will need 37,000 critical care beds. New York State has 3,000 critical care beds. So if you just think about the overwhelming demand on the hospital system, it's not just that patients who have COVID aren't going to be able to get care. You know, what if you have something else? What if you get into a car accident? What if you have a heart attack? You know, and you're coming into a hospital system where there aren't the beds available. This is really a strain on everybody's care. So it's important that we decrease the speed that people are getting coronavirus. So while, you know, social distancing may not prevent the virus from spreading at all, what it does is it slows how quickly the virus spreads. And that means that as people get sick, then they'll have the resources in the healthcare system to be able to take care of and handle that.
You hear people talking about coronavirus, and there's always these two big things they talk about. One is old people, and the other are people who are sick. Now, the second part, people who are sick, is there certain types of illnesses or things that we should be concerned about that is a typical profile of a COVID-19 patient? And how does that look like for Black people?
What we're finding is that people who have pre-existing conditions, meaning people who have chronic illness already, are more likely to get severe coronavirus. And one of the biggest risk factors for that is actually hypertension. All of us got hypertension. We don't really think about hypertension as something that necessarily makes you very sick or sickly. But we're finding that people who have high blood pressure in particular are the ones who are more likely to need hospitalization for this. Black people are the most likely to have hypertension. You know, of all populations in the U.S., we're affected the most. So we have to think that we're at particular risk for this.
So people are throwing around this word comorbidity. And you just spoke about hypertension, which is a comorbidity. Can you tell listeners what comorbidities are and kind of the spectrum of comorbidities that impact Americans, which kind of make us a little bit different from Italy and China? And then more specifically, the ones that impact Black people.
Some of us come to coronavirus with our own ailments, our own medical ailments, right? So say I'm walking around and on a normal day, I have high blood pressure and diabetes. High blood pressure and diabetes are comorbidities given that I get coronavirus. In other countries, the mortality rate was higher in people who had these comorbidities. But in our country, comorbidities are more likely. You know, we have, I think 2/3 of us are affected by, are either overweight or obese. You know, the prevalence of hypertension, diabetes, these things are really very, very common in our population. We're getting this epidemic or pandemic rather, but also it's being overlaid on a population that has chronic health conditions. For Black people, we know that we are much more affected by chronic conditions than other populations in the U.S. We are more likely to have diabetes. We are more likely to have heart disease. We are really more likely to have hypertension. Asthma. Asthma is an epidemic in our communities, right? Autoimmune disease, lupus. We're coming to this virus with more in the background that kind of complicates things. So autoimmune diseases, one of these diseases is lupus, which is what I study. We find that a lot of these diseases are more common in women and much more common in African Americans, and that's particularly the case in lupus. So for example, for every one white woman who has lupus, there are 4 to 5 Black women who have lupus. So much more common and tends to be more severe as well.
So Ashir, how are things at your job? Because you are a practicing physician. Why don't you tell the family a little background of how things are at work for you right now with all this stuff going on?
So this whole coronavirus outbreak has really just changed everything in our world. We are not only suspending research, but a lot of docs who do very specialized care are being pulled into taking care of these patients because our hospitals are already becoming overrun with patients who have symptoms. We are getting a lot of correspondence from our hospitals that basically says that all physicians, even ones who don't have a background necessarily in critical care or who don't regularly perform critical care, are going to be retrained to staff the hospitals because even now at this early stage of the epidemic, the physician workforce is already being depleted. In the midst of all of this, I'm hearing that, you know, in the coming weeks, I'm going to be really, really on the front lines of all of this. And that, you know, a lot of my colleagues, some of whom are older, some of whom have chronic medical conditions, are going to have to be taking care of these patients. So it's just a really nerve-wracking time for me. And it's a really emotional time for me because, you know, like we say this thing is causing fatalities in 2 to 3% of people. And that means 1 in 50 or 1 in 33, right? Like I know 50 people. I work with 50 people. I work with 33 people. You know, the likelihood that I'm going to see this affect the people who I work with every day and care about is very high. And so like dealing with the realities of that while also talking about it and trying to inform the public is just very heavy.
One thing that really scares the shit out of me is that at one point when we run out of beds, physicians and leaders in healthcare are going to have to start making decisions on who gets care. I was reading a case in Italy where they don't have enough beds. They had to decide, do I give a bed to an 80-year-old person who is more than likely not going to survive from this disease, or do I give it to a chronically ill 45-year-old who could survive? And I hate that these types of decisions are going to have to be made. But the thing that makes me so concerned is how that is going to impact the Black community. Because we already experienced this discrimination in care about just simple things like Black women experiencing pain and believing that pain. So, like, what are some things we could and should do if we do become sick to either, you know, combat that discrimination? What are things we can tell our doctors so that they take us serious and give us beds if we need them and they're available? And also, what are things we can do if the worst case scenario happens and we don't get access to care?
So I'm very, very concerned about that as well. So, you know, most of the time when these decisions are made, like who gets the bed or who gets the vent, there are objective scores that we use to determine who's most likely to survive in a given critical care situation. So I think the only thing racially that influences those scores is that, you know, again, as we talked about, Black people are more likely to have background issues, so background comorbidities. So, you know, a Black person coming in who is chronically ill and then gets coronavirus on top of that might have a lower score than someone who doesn't, right? But the thing that just gives me so much anxiety about this is that, you know, we talk about the number of ICU beds that are going to be needed, and we talk about the number of ICU beds that we have. But we know that not all people have equal access to all of those beds, right? Like in New York, at least, we have a public hospital system, and it is already more strained than the private sector. And Black and Brown people are more likely to depend on the public hospitals. So, you know, shrink that number of beds down to whatever you can get with your insurance and, you know, or lack thereof in your financial situation, then the pot of resources for Black people and Brown people is smaller than for the general population. On top of that, you know, the number of doctors that are available, the facilities, the infrastructure that's available in those systems is not on pace with the general population. So what we can do about it is stop, you know, thinking that this is not a thing, right? Like we especially have to take this seriously. We especially have to make sure it doesn't spread in our communities because, you know, should we need that care, our resources are going to be less. How to make your doctor take you seriously. I would say that most doctors are taking this, most doctors that I talk to, are taking this seriously. And as testing comes online, which has been shamefully slow, but as testing is coming online, and then just being aware of the symptoms, you know, the most common symptoms are fever and cough. Less common symptoms are, you know, sore throat, malaise, like all of those go along with the syndrome. But, you know, right now, if you go to your doctor and you say, I've been having fever and cough, and by the way, this person is sick too, I think it's coronavirus. I think that people are going to be tested for it.
Are either of you aware of any initial, I know like China, for example, had like a lot of makeshift hospitals and like stadiums and things like that. Are there any efforts in the US similar?
Yeah, in New York there is. So actually Governor Cuomo announced this morning that they're deploying these 1,000-bed cruise ships. So they're going to be in the New York Harbor and they're going to be converted into essentially a 1,000-bed hospital facility. So there's big talk about how to expand our health infrastructure. And that's one thing that is going to be a resource.
And another new possibly positive upside that was in the news today at the time we're recording this actually includes lupus medication and the potential of that being used to treat COVID-19. Could you tell us a little bit about that as well?
I think the news just broke before we started this that chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine is now FDA approved for treating COVID-19. We know that medication very well because we use it in lupus. So that is one of the medications that we use to control disease on a day-to-day basis in our lupus patients. So it's just sort of a quirk in how hydroxychloroquine works that it also helps with autoimmune disease. But it turns out that with this virus in particular, it seems to decrease how quickly the virus can make copies.
Got it. And can we go back to symptoms and this concept of being asymptomatic? Jeannie and I know you had a question about that.
So let's say we experience fever or cough, or I think the thing that's scary about it is that a lot of young people especially are asymptomatic or don't develop symptoms until later. If we have an elder in the home that is sick, should we be there? How do we care for that person, but also care for the community? Is there anything we can do? Should that person be in the hospital?
People who are sick and who have milder symptoms should stay home. You know, this virus has a sort of long incubation period. So, you know, there between the time that you become exposed to the virus and the time that you start exhibiting symptoms, so about half of people will start exhibiting symptoms by 5 to 6 days. By day 11 or 12, almost 100% of people will experience symptoms, but there's a time period in there where you're pre-symptomatic, which may contribute to infecting other people. I would say if there's somebody who's an elder in your household and you don't have symptoms, be mindful of being in close contact with that person, you know, because you don't want to spread it to them, even if you don't have symptoms. And then once that person is infected, if they're high risk, I would consider having that person go to the hospital. Because again, this is a slowly evolving condition. Someone can start off with very mild symptoms and then worsen quickly. So if you have a person who is, you know, in that over 65 group of people who has, you know, some background condition, I would consider getting that person medical care sooner rather than later. As far as how to take care of each other when one person is sick and the other person isn't, they're living in the same household, I think this is a huge issue with this pandemic, because, you know, we're asked to shelter in place. This is a different strategy than other countries have taken. So in China and North Korea, anyone who was infected was actually just quarantined. And so they didn't have this shelter in place with your family members system, because we know that once one family member is infected, the other people who are living in the household have about an 80% chance of also contracting the virus. But there are steps you can take to prevent that. The CDC recommends having a sick room. So if somebody is ill, delegate one room of the house to that person. When people have to come in and out, you know, mask, gloves, make sure that you're washing your hands before and after, and sort of make that arbitrary separation in your home.
I want to get into questions and answers. A lot of you, before we spoke about it or posted anything, have asked questions. And so we welcome those questions. Now we are going to take time to answer them. We're not going to have time to go through all of them. However, I don't believe that we should have any question unanswered. Please check the show notes, because we will put those questions there. And we will talk to Ashir to get some answers around those questions and at least provide resources for you. Let's get started with a Q&A. What is the typical life cycle of a virus of this nature?
Once someone becomes exposed to the virus and there's an initial infection, generally there's a pre-symptomatic period that is somewhere between 5 or 6 days and 14 days. Almost all people who will show symptoms of the virus will show symptoms by day 14, which is why we're hearing this 14-day quarantine rule. Once someone develops symptoms, generally they are symptomatic between 7 days and 14 days. On average, if someone is going to need hospitalization, it happens by day 8 or 10. So that's the time where somebody might sort of turn and need more intensive care. After the symptoms resolve, there's about 14 days where a person may feel fine but still shed the virus. And what that means is that even though you don't have symptoms anymore, the virus may be present in your saliva, in whatever your mucus, when you cough or sneeze, the virus may be present in those secretions. The longest shedding period that's been reported is about 20 days. But, you know, from start to finish, someone might have virus in their system for about 4 to 6 weeks. We don't know if someone who's shedding virus after they've gotten better is still contagious. We just know that it's present in the saliva, right? So I think in the hospitals, for example, when people have recovered from the virus, they can go back to work after 3 days, but they still have to wear a mask and gloves so that they don't infect other people for up to 2 weeks. We presume that that person can still infect other people, but it's really unclear at the moment.
Okay, so the next question is about genetics. Is there a population of people that are genetically predisposed to the virus? Not necessarily more vulnerable, just more likely based on genes, dietary history, proximity to clean water, and so forth. I'm not making the case for anything crazy, but I wonder.
Yeah, so nobody knows that. Janina, I don't know, do you have...
I can go ahead and take this one if you want. For everything that we know, there has been some studies that have looked at the genetics of the host immune system. And so this is, you know, your genome and seeing if there are signatures in your genome that make you triggers an immune response that might help you survive or mitigate very severe outcomes. This was done for, I believe, the first SARS and tested in MERS. A lot of these were all done in white people. A lot of these were very small sample sizes. A lot of these have not been replicated. And also, a lot of scientists have wrote papers that said, hey, we don't observe the same thing. So we can't assume that it's genetic. And what we know about our genomes, what we know about the immune system, it is unlikely, but there are no studies that prove this. The way I like to think about science, it needs to be replicated several times across a lot of different populations and large sample sizes before I believe it's real. Okay, so our next question kind of relates to the first question. It's a super popular question. I think 4 or 5 people have asked it. I've read 2 cases where people have cured, quote unquote, but tested positive again. Is this possible?
Probably not is the answer to that. We know our immune systems have memory. So once we're exposed to one virus or bacteria, our immune system says, I know what that is. And if we get exposed to it again, we mount a response faster than we can develop symptoms. That's the premise behind vaccines. Now, with this virus, as we talked about earlier, it can hang around in your system for a very long time. So I think what's probably happened with the cases where somebody had what seems to be a relapse is that, you know, perhaps the person had the virus, developed symptoms, started feeling better, but still had some viral copies in their system. And then maybe something else happened. They got stressed or, you know, there was another reason why their immune system stopped being able to control the little bit of virus that they had. And all of a sudden the virus could, you know, ramp up again and cause symptoms again. You know, all of our testing for this requires a certain amount of the virus to be present. So say someone's at the tail end of their illness, the immune system is keeping the virus in check, there's a lower number of copies, we can't detect it, and then all of a sudden the virus is able to replicate again, now you get above the threshold for protection, for detection rather, and you can get another positive test.
Next question. Is there any truth to Black people having less ACE2 enzymes in their body? I read that this is, quote, an open parentheses, may be the reason why Black people may be more resistant, open parentheses, not immune, close parentheses, to coronavirus.
So, no. There's no evidence that Black people have more or less ACE receptors, nor is there evidence that Black people are more or less resistant to this disease.
So just to clarify, ACE2 is a protein found on the surface of cells in your heart and lung. There's also a class of drugs called ACE inhibitors. Ashira could tell us a little bit more about those medications.
Medications in the category of ACE inhibitors. So a lot of us take these, lisinopril, captopril, anything that ends in pril. it's a medicine that we use commonly for high blood pressure. It also is used in people who have chronic heart conditions. So, you know, your heart and lung tissues increase the number of ACE receptors on the outside of the cells. And this coronavirus enters the cells using those same receptors.
I've heard some rumors that people should stop taking medications because they have these comorbidities and the comorbidities are like causing them to get disease. Is that true?
So this is moving faster than we can move in science. There's a really big caveat there. We already have stuff that kills us, right? Like hypertension has been killing Black people long before coronavirus. So, you know, we don't want to get into a situation where people who have chronic illnesses that do affect their health negatively are doing fine on their medicines, but then stop them because they're scared of coronavirus. So I think the medical community is really trying to balance that right now.
And can we go back to that myth of Black people being resistant to COVID-19 and where else that misconception may have come from?
I think it's really interesting because just sort of to add this, a lot of people are saying, oh, well, see, Africa is not the epicenter of this outbreak. Like, you know, we're not seeing a ton of cases in Africa. Does that mean that Black people are resistant? You have to remember, they just had Ebola. And so they have all the equipment and infrastructure to detect early the cases, quarantine early, treat, and then make sure that their population is not exposed. So like one of my really good friends is an internist in Liberia, and she says that as soon as these cases started popping up in China, everyone who came through the airport got a questionnaire. There was fever screening for everyone coming into the country. All the buildings that you walk in and out of have fever monitors so they can determine the temperature of the crowds as they pass through. And people who have fevers are taken aside and tested. So they've done a really good job of making sure this doesn't start off in their communities in ways that we are just slow to do in the U.S. I asked that too of my colleagues in Nigeria and Liberia and Ghana. So they got testing before we did. So they took they got the tests from the WHO. So they were able to test more widely even before we did here in the U.S.
Okay, this is a big question. When will this be over?
Not soon enough. We don't know. We really don't know. The spread of this, there are you can do modeling for this, right? Like you can look at how many people one person who gets infected is likely to infect, and then the rate at which new people get infections, and then the rate at which people in the population have immunity, and then how those curves might rise or fall depending on how much we are coming in contact with each other. All of that really is guesswork at the moment. We're hoping that this will be several months, but it could be a year. It could be a little more than a year. It just depends on how this plays out.
We don't know how long this will last because we don't know how effective we are at the preventative measures that we're taking now. We just don't know. And right. One of the biggest reasons why we don't know is because of tests. So the next question, and I can answer this one if you want. Where are the tests made and why are they scarce?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So the history of the tests. When coronavirus first came out, a lot of people didn't know it was coronavirus. There was just an assumption that there was, you know, people were getting pneumonia who were living in Wuhan. But then when it became apparent that all of these people were working at the same place, we began to think, oh, this must be a virus. There was a test that was developed by the Chinese that was used there when it was an epidemic and only in China. And then the World Health Organization took over and they developed a test as well. There are private entities that also develop tests. You see this in South Korea where they are using tests that are provided by the World Health Organization as well as private entities. Now, the question is what happened with us when we started, when the virus started to come to the U.S., what tests were we using? Well, our government said that we're not going to use the World Health Organization test or any test that is coming from another country, that we're going to utilize our CDC that already has a test. So why would the CDC have a test already? As Ashira mentioned, the coronavirus or SARS-CoV-2 is actually very similar to other coronaviruses. So for us to manipulate an existing test with a few changes that make it unique to the current coronavirus is quite easy. So done. But this was a rush order. And when rush orders happen, we all make mistakes. It's a very human thing. Human error happens. And so our test, we didn't make a lot of them because of capacity. We sent that test out to the places that were the most infected at the time. These labs were getting the CDC tests, and the tests were coming up with false negative results, which means that people were testing negative, but in fact actually had the virus. They caught this really early on. They knew the tests were erroneous. It turned out later that there were some off-target, the test was not specific enough, essentially, and that was due to contamination issues that the CDC had going on when they were shipping these tests out. Now, what happens in those 4 to 5 days are people are going home and doing what? Spreading it to their people. So that is the thing that happened with the tests. About a week ago, our government had announced that they're going to partner with private entities like Quest and LabCorp to mass produce tests. So now we have tests that are being mass produced. In theory, they are no longer scarce. However, in theory, they are also somewhat no longer relevant. And the reason why I say that is not because knowing if you're positive or negative changes, you know, how we treat you. It definitely does. But the reason why I say that is because so much has spread since we were not testing, and so many people are untested and asymptomatic and are spreading the disease. What we could have done had we had these tests before were isolate people who tested positive regardless of their symptoms. Because what that does is it automatically prevents the spread of the virus. And by automatically preventing the spread of the virus, you, of course, then do not put as much pressure on the hospital network. Having the test after the fact is really good for us understanding the numbers. And a lot of the epidemiologists and statisticians are predicting that the death rate now is probably overestimated because of the amount of people that have been tested. And why they think that is that because once we take into account all of the people who have not been tested, so once testing becomes very, very standard, then that number will start to decrease. However, you know, right now we just don't know. Okay, this question, how do you qualify for testing?
Qualifying for testing, and I think that the qualifications for testing have become more liberal as testing has come online. So generally, you qualify for testing by having symptoms of disease, and you're more likely to get tested if you have a contact who has COVID-2 or have been to an endemic country. The travel recommendations are changing quite a bit. In general, people who have been exposed but are asymptomatic are not being offered tests.
Can you tell us the difference between SARS-CoV-2 and the flu in terms of spread and how long the virus lives on surfaces?
SARS-CoV-2, first, is more contagious than the flu is. So we talk about this in terms of R-naught. So given that I'm infected, how many people do I expect to infect? And so the number for SARS-CoV-2 is about 1 to 2 more people than for the flu. Just person-to-person contact, you're going to spread it a little bit more. The other thing is that this virus, you know, it's not considered classically airborne in that the viral particles can't just survive in the wind, but they can survive in all of the little bits of saliva that we spew when we cough and sneeze. So those droplets can stay in the air for a couple hours, so 2 to 3 hours or so. As well, on certain surfaces, especially surfaces like glass and hard surfaces like your iPhone, SARS-CoV-2 can survive for up to 72 hours, so 3 days. Given that it's been deposited somewhere, the virus can be live and infectious for a longer period of time than we would expect for a flu virus. And then lastly, you know, we talked about how long people are asymptomatic and whether or not those periods of time, the virus can be transmitted to other people. And so for SARS-CoV-2, people can be asymptomatic for up to 14 days. Usually they're not. Most people will have symptoms by day 11 or 12, but there's a long pre-incubation period before you develop symptoms, longer than for the flu. And after you have symptoms, there's a longer period of time that you continue to shed the virus and may be able to infect other people.
What is the likelihood the virus will mutate and infect other bodily systems or broader age groups?
Probably there are underappreciated organ systems that are already being affected. Younger age groups are also already being affected. So it's hard for me to say the virus mutates and therefore, because it doesn't require a mutation. One of the things I didn't realize, you know, this is just about the virus and its clinical course. You know, it's a SARS virus. So SARS stands for Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. We all think of the respiratory symptoms and someone coming in getting viral pneumonia, and that does happen and it's a huge problem. But the underappreciated thing is that the virus also affects the heart and it affects the liver. One of the most terrifying things that happens is that, you know, somebody comes in with this, they have the respiratory distress, you get them better from that standpoint, they appear to be turning the corner, and then all of a sudden they go into shock. And then you do an ultrasound of their heart and the heart is pumping at 10% of its capacity. And, you know, whenever the heart muscle is working that poorly, it can't stay in rhythm very well. So people develop these fatal arrhythmias. And so it leads to just sudden death. You know, there's probably a component of viral infection of the heart. The other thing that's happening is that people are getting injury to their liver. So thankfully, this is not causing all-out liver failure, but the liver is the processing center for the body. That means that anything you put in your mouth, especially medications, has to be processed through the liver in order for it not to be toxic to your body. So when someone comes in and they have this liver injury due to the virus, it limits the medications that we can give them to help and fight it. So the biggest problem with that is that, you know, people who have liver injury aren't able to get all the medicines that we might think would help them.
This question has literally been popping up everywhere. And I'm not sure who started this trail of misinformation. But the question is, can I kill the virus sitting in a sauna? Can I kill the virus by putting a blow dryer to my face? And another question that was, well, will the virus just die when it gets hot outside?
Okay, so no. And actually, you know, I heard this too, because somebody was like, oh, you can catch a cold, but you can't catch a hot. And I'm like, what?
Like, you can't catch a hot?
So no, the heat is not going to kill this virus. Like, all of us are walking around with basal temperatures of, you know, 98.3, 98.5. You know, you're not getting in a sauna that's hot enough to kill this virus, nor can blow drying your face kill the virus.
Right, because from what I understand, it's the conditions that the virus is living in, right? So, like, the virus is living inside of you, and inside of you should never be 120 degrees. So,
right.
No. Next question. How are you hospital doctors dying from it? If they are dying, do any of us stand a chance?
I mean, we're exposed, right? Like, and this really goes back to the reason why it's so important for people to just follow guidelines and stay home, because we don't have a choice as to whether or not we're going to come into the hospital and try and save lives. We took an oath to do this. This is our profession. This is our passion. So we are going to have to make sacrifices. And for some of us, unfortunately, that sacrifice will be our lives. And so, you know, as a physician, to look on the news and see people partying on the beach or taking advantage of real cheap airline prices because this coronavirus has the prices ridiculous, right? You just say, wow, like, how selfish can people be? You know, like, understanding that you're putting yourself and other people at risk. The number of people who come into the hospital will be higher than the number of doctors who can serve them. And than the amount of protective equipment that we have available. And so because of that influx, we will have to risk our lives. The luxury that you have as someone who is not a healthcare professional is that you can protect yourself and you can stay home and you can protect your family. I can't. I have to go to the hospital and I have to be around people who have this. So yes, you stand a chance because you can follow the guidelines. and you can stay safe. Some of us aren't that lucky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm, you know, I'm sorry you have to deal with this. I don't know. It's very brave. What are ways that we can help volunteer empower the Black community and other marginalized groups to stay home and stop spreading the virus?
Stop spreading misinformation.
Yes.
For one. So if you hear somebody say something that you know is not right, like Black people can't get this, this is a hoax, somebody paid Idris Elba to say that he had it, you know, just shut that down. You know, make sure that those narratives aren't spreading, because what we think precedes what we do. And if what we do is spread this stuff like wildfire, like, everybody's in trouble. So I think that's the number one thing for me. What about you, Jamina?
Yeah, I was going to say one of the things I think I would like to see people do is to start thinking about we're creative. You know, let's just tap into the resiliency that we have. My news feed is already flooded with a bunch of creative things. My sister has been sending me pictures of her artwork every day. My group chats are filled with books and things that we should read. Let's just continue to support how we can make the best out of this situation. Let's applaud all these creative ways in which we're using to socialize and to overcome this. And let's applaud people for staying home. Let's also support the people who have to be at the front line with whatever they need. Whatever they need to help them, if that means preparing meals for them before they have to go to the hospital, if that means you going to Home Depot and buying some PPE that you can, you know, send to that person to send to the hospital. These are things. One thing I want to also bring to the forefront is that we need to remember a lot of people are not even in the privilege to be able to stay at home. We have the easiest job. A lot of people aren't talking about the prison population, for example, a population of majority Black and brown folks who have to live in very close quarters. The lack of care and compassion for these people is already non-existent, unheard of, silenced. I think we just have an opportunity to really affect big change by doing something that's so, so simple. I would just reorient to people to listening to things like the podcast, and please read our show notes. We're going to have a lot of information for you to read those show notes. And really, we're also going to provide information for you to cope with the mental capacity that we're all having to deal with as a result of coronavirus. Ashira, you know, unfortunate times, but I'm so grateful to have you a part of my circle. And we are grateful to have you in a community working on health disparities. Just so y'all know, Ashira travels to the continent and is doing very, 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 very mindful consent and research on Africans on the continent, Africans in the Caribbean, African Americans here, to really combat health disparities. She is so dedicated to this work. Are there any last words you want to tell the family?
Well, first I'll say, take care of each other. You know, I think what I've learned in tackling health disparities around the diaspora is that we're nothing if we aren't creative. And a lot of times we may not have the same access, but we have a lot of necessity, and necessity is the mother of invention. And so I've just been really overwhelmed with the ways in which my co-collaborators and the people who I've encountered make sure that we have a system that works for us. And I think that COVID-19 is no different than that. There are going to be ways in which we are more impacted, and we're just going to have to rally and take care of each other. So I think that the story of health disparities in general is a story of resilience. And the one thing that I'm excited to see as this progresses is how we have our ingenuity make sure that our communities are protected.
Thank you. Thank you. I love it. Thank you so much. All right, fam, we reached the end of the episode, and it's gene therapy time. the segment in which we affirm our genomes. On today's Gene Therapy, I want to talk a bit about the circle of life. No, not the song with Simba and Mufasa in them, but more so about viruses, humans, other species of animals, and the nature of how we all coexist together. First of all, there are over 200 viruses in humans alone. And if you look at all living organisms, other animals, plants, bacteria, there are over 10 non-nillion of them. That's 10 with 30 zeros behind it. Scientists estimate that less than 1% of viruses actually cause disease. Viruses, just like us, want to live their best non-living lives in every space they're allowed to inhabit. And believe it or not, they do a lot of good in the world. Viruses are found in a very large number of ocean bacteria, and this partnership between the two is extremely beneficial in maintaining life in our oceans. Viruses in the ocean kill 20% of the ocean microbial biomass, which directly impacts nutrients for other species and, of course, our own energy cycle. Viruses in plants can help them survive extreme conditions like drought or winter. Besides keeping our oceans great, viruses can also have a direct positive impact on mammals. Inactive herpes viruses have been found to be beneficial in fighting off the bubonic plague in mice. Have you ever chewed on a piece of bread and after a while it started to taste sweet? You can thank a virus for that. Viral DNA in our genomes tell our salivary glands to produce an enzyme, amylase, that makes carbs taste sweet. And tasty food helps us eat and thus ensures our survival.
Tastes so good, make you want to slap your mama, don't it, Willie?
Yeah, boy.
Even before we're born, viruses hold us down. The human placenta that allows embryos to receive nutrients has proteins that evolved from viruses. We can't really hold viruses accountable for functioning how they were made and living their best non-living lives. But in the coming days, weeks, and possibly even months, we can hold each other accountable. We can hold our government here in the States accountable for not accepting adequate testing from the World Health Organization when it was presented to us. We can hold our friends accountable for choosing to go out and party even while knowing that doing so would put us all at risk for overwhelming our hospitals with rapid spread of the virus. We can hold ourselves accountable for xenophobic remarks, the spreading of misinformation, the hoarding of resources, and lack of empathy for one another. And in the coming days, weeks, and months, I truly believe we can turn this thing around, kick that Rona off our couch, and all live our best collective lives as a community going forward. See you in the future, fam. Peace.
We got to smile, bitch! Smile, bitch! Come on!
For a list of resources of where you can find out more information about that Rona, the politics around that Rona, how to take care of yourself mentally in the time of that Rona, and much more, check out our show notes. Special thanks to Dr. Ashira Blazer. More information about our guest today will be available in the show notes. If you love this episode, we have more coming for you. This podcast is independently funded. And so if you would like to hear more, we really need your help, fam. It truly takes a village. We can't rely on big corporations to sustain our work. We have felt very strongly about the show's integrity. So it's important to us to find the right partner that sees our vision and does not water down or whitewash our tone and message. Until then, we are relying on our community to sustain our production. To support funding for the show, you can help us out monetarily and non-monetarily. Some monetary ways that you can help the growth of our show are by contributing to our GoFundMe campaign, It Takes a Village. Any donation is beneficial to us. We are looking to raise money to buy equipment, pay our staff, fund any travel needed to record, and for mixing and mastering of our episodes. Podcasting is expensive, fam. You can find the link to our GoFundMe campaign in the description of the episode. You can also become a monthly sustainer of our show through our Patreon. That entails committing to donate any amount of money to our show every month. If helping us out monetarily isn't feasible for you, there are other ways that you can help us out. That includes telling your family and friends about the show, subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app, giving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing the episode on social media. In Those Jeans would not be possible without our close family. Our lead producer and audio unicorn, Sam Riddell, really is the mastermind behind the show. Sam produces, co-writes, audio engineers, mixes, scores, and coaches me. A huge thanks to Chris Diggins, our creative director, who brings the idea for all the clever Black culture analogies you hear in the show. The music you hear was produced by the one and only Chad Milliner. Our intro music this week is Fuck the Corona by Gotti Boy Chris. The term geneticist was created by Rebecca Lewis. Be sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at In Those Jeans Pod. In Those Jeans is created, hosted, written, and executive produced by me, Dr. Janina Jeff.